This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we visit with Sue Balcom about the importance of cover crops in our gardens. And we are going to start today with Dr. Adnan Akyüz. He is the state climatologist as we talk about the drought conditions across the state. Dr. Akyüz, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So I looked at the drought map, which comes out on a weekly basis. The update this morning has 48.6% of the state in extreme drought, 96.7% of the state is in what we call a severe drought, and of course 100% of the state is in an abnormally dry, moderate drought conditions. First of all, let's just talk about that extreme drought number. How much of a change is this from 1 week to this?
There is only 1% change. The only addition compared to the last week was a small finger-like shape coming into Williams and McKenzie counties to the west and continues into Montana.
Okay.
And the other portion that we included in extreme drought is the western, northeastern Pembina County. And those are the new additions. And that happens to be the largest extent on record since 2000.
Wow. Is a 1% increase a sign that things are starting to stabilize, or is that a small percentage of growth because that number is already high?
It is already a high number. Last week we had a reduction, and this week we had introduction of development of the drought. So it is really bad conditions if that is what you're after. The farmers are hurt. Western North Dakota has been in drought since last year, actually, mm-hmm. Starting from June. And if you look at the past nine months since October, that will make the entire state the third driest and 10th warmest. And the dryness and the warmth together usually goes hand by hand, and unfortunately they feed into each other to put us into a positive feedback. And even though there is nothing positive about the drought conditions, but one exacerbates the impact of the other, we call it positive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
With many counties, the driest, when you look into the individual counties, for example, Montreal, Ward, McLean, and Mercer County are the driest nine-month period on record. And some of the other counties all around are having their fair share of the dryness. At the same time, the temperature-wise, being the 10th warmest, and you got to keep in mind certain counties are in worse conditions than the other. So the warm conditions are not really helping.
Mm-hmm.
As the air temperatures are higher, it becomes more capable of holding more water vapor that needs to evaporate from any aftermath of a precipitation from the soil, from the plants. And as we know, the soil is extremely dry and parched. And I'm afraid that evaporation is coming from the deeper portions of the state, the soil, I should rather say, and exacerbating the conditions, the drought conditions in those areas.
Wow. Yeah, so not only are we not getting enough rain, but any little precipitation there is, it's just not going far enough because of that evaporation.
Exactly. You have to think in terms of an economy where you would have an income and expenditure, and your income in this case would be the rainfall and expenditure would be the evaporation, and you have to subtract the second part from the first. In other words, evaporation is subtracted from incoming precipitation to give us an idea of what the water budget is going to be.
Mm.
And as the conditions are warmer than normal, and there is no soil moisture to evaporate, what evaporate does is it helps the atmosphere cool, because you need an energy to evaporate the moisture from the soil, and that needs to come from the income. When there is no evaporation, so the entire 100% of the solar radiation is utilized to warm up the atmosphere even further. So you get into this the loop of a positive feedback feeding into each other to keep dry areas drier and wet areas wetter.
Are there impacts on things like erosion when it's this dry? I'm thinking dry soil probably blows away at a higher rate than a heavier, wetter soil.
Yeah, that would be the case when the area had not seen rainfall for a long period of time and the wind speed is high enough to dislodge the top portions of the soil to move far distances. And in fact, Monday's case of high wind areas, the Fargo even saw that the wind blast or the sand blast coming from all the way to the western North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Other thing with the dry soil and the rain is that even if the region is blessed with the rain, and unfortunately those rains came in terms of isolated showers, as one place did receive rainfall and the other places all around did not. So that was hit and miss. And places that did get hit with the rainfall, they received a significant amount of precipitation, even about 1 inch. And last month we've seen up to 6 inch of rain in case of the Williston areas. And when the soil is dry and crusty, the most of that topsoil either being eroded or it just stewed on top of the soil without being infiltrated and overran into the nearest ditches to cause even flooding in the Williston case.
Mm-hmm.
So that rainfall would have been very helpful if the soil wasn't extremely dry. It would infiltrate into the soil and would be utilized when needed. And unfortunately, it did not happen. And that is the story of all that rainfall event so far we have received since the beginning of the growing season this year.
Wow. We are having some air quality issues because of the smoke that's in the air with the fires out in the western part of this state and then even more so the western part of the country and into Canada. Is any of the air quality impact also because of this dust and loose soil in the air?
Absolutely. They have a relation between the fire and the dryness. When the soil is dry and the plants are dry, they become fuel for any spark. It might be initiated by the natural causes as well as unnatural causes. And unfortunately, not only in Canada, but North Dakota is having its fair share of a fire the season, and so far we have accumulated 1,683 accumulated fires in 2021.
Yeah.
But the major problem that is impacting the air quality is not due to the fires in North Dakota, but our neighbors, northern neighbors in Manitoba, mm-hmm. northern Saskatchewan, even Ontario, they are having their fair share of dryness that created that fire. And unfortunately, any time when we have northerly wind, it doesn't take much effort that the smoke to move into an area, which creates a wonderful sunset and sunrise. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. it impacts health because of the air quality problems.
Right. There's not much that's blocking that wind. There aren't things in between Canada and here that are blocking out, including old growth forests, which can tend to slow down a wildfire. As we look at the extreme drought conditions that almost 49% of the state is facing, 48.6 here, we're looking at crops have stopped growing, pastures are going dormant. This one surprised me. A blue-green algae bloom is causing cattle death. What's happening there?
Yeah, unfortunately, blue-green algae is toxic, and it is going to impact anything drinking that water. And I have been getting pictures from the individual counties having blue and green algae, and unfortunately, that water is unusable. And some of the toxicity is in at levels to be able to kill animals, and sometimes the when the area is large and the farmer's not able to check their the cattle, and sometimes the cattle is used to going into this water holes that are nothing but mud right now, and they get stuck, and unfortunately they die. And reports coming from Williston areas and Williams County, many kettles are dying drinking the water, and it's a big problem. Even if there is water, unfortunately, it is contaminated. Smaller ponds and the water holes depleted their amounts into the air, and what is left over is a very toxic water that is unusable. And this is the situation in most drought-stricken areas in western North Dakota currently.
We're visiting with Adnan Akyüz. He is the North Dakota State Climatologist. We're talking about the current drought conditions. Nearly 50% of the state is in an extreme drought, and almost the entire state is in a severe drought. Adnan, I know that in the southwest of the United States, they're looking at things like severe water restrictions. They're maybe even going into Lake Mead. And I'm wondering what measures the state has had to implement, particularly for the farmers and ranchers and the people who are producing the food and the things that we're eating.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the Southwest is having not extreme only, but exceptional drought conditions,
right,
especially in Utah and its neighbors in Nevada, down south in Arizona, New Mexico, and Canada. And lately, D4 or exceptional drought conditions are added into Washington and Oregon. And some water restrictions comes from these states, and fortunately, and we do not have that measures yet, even though we have D4 conditions, or it is the last stage or the heaviest stage of the drought conditions based on the categorization of the National Drought Mitigation Center, and the state is experiencing 8% of the state is experiencing exceptional drought. That happened only three times in the past, 2006, 2017, and again this year. This year's extension of the D4 is 10 weeks since May 18. That is the highest of that. Came 18% covering the state on June 29, and that is currently is the highest extent since 2000. The reason that I go back to 2000 is that we started processing the drought monitor this way since 2000.
Are these drought-like conditions occurring more frequently as you've been monitoring these records?
It is actually as our temperatures are increasing, and we are right at the epicenter of the increasing temperatures in the United States, being in the middle of the continent. As the air temperature increases, as I said earlier, its capability of holding water vapor is going to increase, meaning that that water vapor would have to come from either locally provided moisture sources such as lakes and the soil and the plants, and it is going to cause droughts. And as the air is holding more water vapor, that means it is capable of producing heavier rainfalls. And this is exactly what is happening. And as we are having droughts at this intensity and the frequency at the same time, it is possible that these heavy rainfall events, just like it happened in Stutzman County in Jamestown and Williston in the Williams County, we've been experiencing that. And that is a byproduct of increasing temperatures and making more room in the air to be able to hold more water vapor. And I'm afraid this is going to be the case as long as the air temperature has at its own intensity right now, and the temperatures are increasing, one of the most rapidly in the United States.
What can individuals do
to mitigate the impact?
Yeah.
Well, we are lucky that the NDSU has an extension service that reaches to individual counties, and the county agents are informing their contingencies, the farmers and the ranchers in the area, weekly. They are getting together at meetings, and they are getting information for example, what to do and how to prepare their ranches in drought. We've been having meetings since the end of the winter. We didn't even wait until the growing season came. And county agents were invited. Ranchers and the farmers were invited to these meetings. And these meetings were all about mitigating the impact of the drought, how to manage their ranches for drought. For example, buying hay, more hay, versus selling heads were some of the discussion topics. What type of the crops to the plant and when to harvest, whether or not plant versus take the loss, preventive loss. So these kind of the meetings are designed to help farmers to mitigate the impact of the drought. At the same time, the state has been having biweekly meetings, and Department of Agriculture, Forest Service, Natural Resources, they all are invited to these meetings to for them to take mitigation efforts, such as making some money available for farmers to maintain their water holes and hauling waters, maintaining the wells, and making the hay available at the hay call. It's a matchmaking program puts together. People are in the need of hay versus people have excessive hays. So these are the things that the farmers are taking advantage. And unfortunately, drought is very intense, and it had been impacting the state for a long period of time, and some loss is going to be inevitable.
Mm-hmm. These sound like measures that are mostly taken in what would be this sort of acute problem of right now we have to act, address the head wound first, for example. But I'm wondering, are you able to inform, particularly the state, a policy that can help this on a more chronic level and maybe even start to do some prevention work?
Absolutely. I think that is a great idea. And the policies are in place already, and many policies I wasn't even aware that existed have been surfacing right now. It is just it's a matter of making those policies put into the work to make the farmers in a better position than what it would be without the policies. And they are being activated as we speak, for short term as well as the long term.
What is the economic impact of a prolonged drought? I know you can't put an exact number on that, but an estimate.
Yeah, we can take a look at the droughts in the past and look at the economic impacts. For example, Currently, we have an accumulated impact. We know where we are. We can compare that based on certain drought indices. We can know that this is very much comparable to 2017 and 2006 and even 2002 to 2006. And some of the numbers are very much comparable in terms of the drought indices. And we know the economic impact during those times. For example, in 2017, the economic impact to North Dakota alone was $1 to $2 billion.
Wow.
In 2006, the economic impact was $0.5 to $1 billion. But you have to keep in mind that in 2006, it was accumulated since 2002. So I need to add those numbers to make between $1 to $1.5 billion. So the drought is costly. To make a better comparison, I think these numbers would give us some kind of indication of what we can expect at the end of this drought, which is really fun to even say the end of the drought. Mm. I think this is the word that the farmers are looking forward to hearing.
I imagine so. There is an opportunity for a little bit of citizen science here, thanks to the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, or CoCoRAS. What is this?
Well, that is one of the fun word that I am involved with, and I am really proud of that. I am the North Dakota coordinators of Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network that relies on the volunteer observers from the age of 12 to 90 years old. These folks get up 7 in the morning and they look at their gauges, and those gauges are accepted by the National Weather Service. It is pretty good. The gauge, 4-inch gauge, it is capable of holding water from 0.01 inch to 10 inches. And by doing so, it's a very cost-effective, and we have about 100 volunteer observers actively providing the precipitation data to CoCoRAS headquarters. By looking at the rainfall or lack of it thereof, we can assess drought much better in a county level, for example.
Mm.
If a rain happens in Minot, it used to represent the entire Ward County, for example. But
oh, wow.
Now, because of the CoCoRAS, we can distinguish eastern Ward County versus western Ward County, so that we know where the D4 line or D3 line should pass through in that county.
And those D4 and D3 lines and all the other numbers on that D is in reference to the drought scale. Adnan Acuse is the state climatologist, and you can find out more about that citizen scientist opportunity at CoCoRAS.org. That's CoCoRAHS.org. Dr. Acuse, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Dozens of wildfires are burning in the U.S., and helicopters and planes are used to fight them.
We are having to hit them with a lot of aircraft very quickly.
But why isn't there enough gas to get off the ground?
The refineries were not made to operate when it's 100-plus degrees.
A firefighting fuel shortage, plus coverage of the Olympics opening ceremony on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Still to come on Main Street, we have a touching story from Director of Radio Bill Thomas, and Sue Balcom will discuss the importance of cover crops. But now, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. It's now estimated the state will have the second highest ending fund balance in history.
It's just a little bit over $1 billion, and the legislature had expected that to be closer to $700 million, so there's about a $300 million excess there over what was expected a few months ago.
State Budget Director Joe Morissette says the state's economy has come back after the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic.
We have our first month ever, we believe, in state history where we collected over $1 billion in a single month. And that was, you know, a big part of that was, of course, the legacy fund transfer of earnings, which was $871 million of that. but still a very strong end to the biennium.
Morissette says these are still preliminary numbers because the books won't be closed until next week. The North Dakota Public Service Commission is now considering the settlement agreement reached between PSC staff, Xcel Energy, and several interveners over an electric rate case. Xcel had filed for a 10.8% electric rate hike last November. That was reduced in March to 9.3%. In the settlement agreement, Xcel would be granted a 3.4% increase. AARP North Dakota was one of the interveners. Josh Askvig is the state director.
Obviously, we'd love to see no increase, but we also understand that there's a need to continue to have reliability. We certainly saw that with some of the storms and those types of things as part of it. But at the end of the day, consumers, we're happy and glad to stand up for consumers and hopeful that the final settlement will be adopted when all is said and done.
The company will also be allowed to implement a $15 per month residential fixed charge. That's up from the current $14.50. Askwig says that's acceptable.
It's the same percentage of the overall increase of that 3.4%. And so, in other words, consumers were not being asked to put more than what they're currently putting into a fixed charge. They're not being asked to do that, as we've seen in other cases.
Also, since Xcel was granted an interim rate increase that is higher than the proposed settlement, customers could see a refund estimated to be about $26 per residential customer. And another step toward the sale of the Coal Creek Station power plant near Underwood. The plant is owned by Great River Energy. The sale is pending to Rainbow Energy of Bismarck. There are some 40-year-old permits that have to be transferred from GRE to Rainbow Energy. One concerns a water line. The other deals with the high-voltage power line. The Public Service Commission has opened a window of opportunity for hearings on the two permits. Commissioners say they're excited to see this movement toward keeping Coal Creek going. Here's Commissioner Randy Christman.
It is really exciting that, you know, to think 45 years later, we're dealing with a potential whole new future with, you know, a different direction for that very important facility to so many people and so many electric users around the entire Midwest.
This action does not mean the sale has been completed, but commissioners say this helps fuel some optimism in coal country. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2021 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2021 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Many of us have had the experience of preparing for a funeral or a celebration of life ceremony, and trying to track down some important piece of remembrance. Director of Radio Bill Thomas talks here with Heather Steinman, who asked us for help in just such a task.
I met Heather when she was an English professor at NDSU over the idea of her students possibly writing for Dakota Date books. And I soon found out also that she was a gifted singer. A few years ago, she went to New Mexico to teach, so I was surprised to get a call from her recently. She was back in North Dakota, and she had a problem that she thought maybe a media professional, that's me, could help her out with.
So my father recently died, and I was writing, with the help of my family, I was writing his obituary, and a big part of his life was music and writing songs and recording songs. And so in his obituary, I had written that he had a song that got some airtime on radio stations in the 80s, which is true. But then we kind of went, what happened to that song? Because it's called I Love You, North Dakota.
Uh-huh.
And we had a recording from the Lakota, North Dakota Centennial celebration or whatever performance.
And Lakota is where your family lived, right?
Yeah. So it was a variety show. And my dad had changed the words for that that performance to say Lakota, North Dakota. So the one that we had a recording of said Lakota, North Dakota. But, you know, my family and I were talking and going, well, that's not what the original which one was the original? Was it I Love You, North Dakota, or Lakota, North Dakota? And honestly, we really don't know. Did he change it for the centennial, or did he change it to be on the radio, or which one came first? But so I was out looking for the other version.
So that's where Heather was hoping I would come in, helping to track down the recording of this song that had been played on the radio. And I wanted to help because I knew they were a musical family. And as with many families, for instance, the siblings sang together at the celebration of life. Heather tells how that came about.
So my dad was in Bethany here in Fargo for a while and then got to go home to Lakota, to the Lakota Good Samaritan Center before he died. But while he was in Bethany, a few times I brought his guitar up and played songs with him. And he was still singing up until pretty close to the end of his life. If you sang a song, he wasn't able to speak very well. I should have said that my father had Parkinson's disease.
Uh-huh.
And so he wasn't able to speak very well, but he could still sing. And he could still catch the tune, and he would even get the harmony sometimes. So despite all of his limitations, he was still able to sing. And we were singing with him and playing guitar, and I said, well, I kind of reached the end of my repertoire, Dad. You know, what do you have any requests for next time? And he said, just a closer walk with thee. And so I went back to my brothers, and we found the lyrics and chords online, and we went back and sang it with my dad in the nursing home. And then since that was the last song that he requested, you know, by name, as far as I know, at the celebration of life, my brother Ted, my sister Gina, and I performed that. Wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be, honestly. You get into a good song and you know...
them at the celebration of life. So the plan was that Heather was going to come down to the studio here at Prairie Public and go on the radio and put out the word to look for a copy of this song. But
I found it. I did. There was, well, I suppose when I was in high school, early 90s, my dad and I did some recording at Backroom Recorders in Devil's Lake, North Dakota, with a guy named Bob Johnson, who has also passed away in the last year, I think. Bob's wife, Betty, was still alive, and I was able to find her and go and visit her, and she handed over this recording. My search ended there because the actual recording studio, you know, she had everything. She hadn't gotten rid of any of the recordings.
Wow, lucky for you.
It was, and it was a really nice visit as well, because Bob and Betty Johnson played with my dad in some bands, and actually Bob Johnson and my dad had played music together since high school, and I honestly can't remember if Bob was in this band called Curtis and the Galaxies with my dad, but they, since when would my dad have been in high school? The 50s, 60s. So they had been playing together for a very long time.
Now, this just makes me think of all the people out there who never tried for one reason or another to be, you know, professional musicians, but keep it as a big part of their lives as they do other things.
That's so funny. Somebody commented on a Facebook post of something about my dad, that, well, if there was America's Got Talent around when your dad was, you know, when your dad was younger, he would have got famous. And I think, I don't, you know what would he have played though? Because he played the piano, the guitar, the saxophone, the accordion. He could sit in on the drums if you asked him to, you know. I don't know what he would have, what would he have done on that show? I couldn't tell you.
So what did he... He wasn't a professional musician. What did he do? What's his life?
Well, he was a farmer, and a teacher primarily. You know, the song I Love You, North Dakota talks about farming in some ways. And later on in his, he did not make it as a farmer in the 80s when a lot of small farms went under. His was one. He just didn't, you know, he wasn't big enough, and that happened to a lot of people. And I know that it broke his heart also, but he also wouldn't have liked to do some of the things that people, big farmers, have to do now. My brother Ted, after my dad died, found that my dad had self-published some poetry online. My dad was just always writing and creating, and he was such a lover of beauty. Actually, that's a funny story about farming. My dad, one time, he loved the way that mustard fields looked. He thought it was beautiful, and so he wanted to plant mustard. And I guess he got into a huge fight with his dad, who was also a farmer, about his dad said, "This isn't the year. No, you can't do it." And my dad did it anyway. And of course, the crop failed. But he was a lover of
it. Looked pretty.
Beauty. It did. Well, I don't know how far it got in the growing cycle, but yeah.
So the song, I Love You, North Dakota, says all these wonderful things about North Dakota and farming and the fields and all the big fields and everything. And this poetry that he published later, he had some other thoughts, right?
It looks like it, and I can't ask him anymore, but this poem is called Signs of Spring, and it goes, "The western meadowlark gone, replaced with herbicide, fungicide, insecticide, and a gas-powered popper to keep the birds and geese away. Flowers gone, replaced with pavers, concrete, and outdoor barbecue grills. Family farms gone, replaced with huge multi-owner conglomerates," you know, et cetera. It goes on and
yeah.
So there's this very sad tone to the poem about the family farm being gone.
Yeah, so he definitely wasn't just a mindless booster of things. He was a critic, too.
He was both very mindful and critical guy, yep.
Yeah. I'm glad you found the song, some other songs as well, and congratulations on your successful search and sharing the story with us.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for talking to me about it.
On endless prairie grasses, the railroads lay their claim. Beside the rails, the wagon trails from which the highways came. A people bold with courage, a land so fresh and new, with faith in God and determination too. I love you, North Dakota, you will always be my home. Your children are your heritage, wherever they may roam. 100 years of progress, living from the land, man and nature walking.
That's Merle Steinman and a recording of a song he wrote in the 80s for the North Dakota Centennial, excavated from the archive of a Devil's Lake studio by his daughter, Heather. Coming up next, Sue Balcom and Cover Crops.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Capitol Shakespeare of Bismarck, in partnership with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, presents Julius Caesar, July 21st through the 25th, 7 p.m. nightly. Chicago guest director Steve Grossman examines the envious Roman society in the time of civil war and unrest. Is Brutus an honorable man who helps kill Caesar for just reasons? Also, the Young Bards Theater Group will do a pre-show performance each night entitled Shakespeare Our Way, directed by Aaron Weckel. Capitol Shakespeare on the Lawn, July 21st through the 25th.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Sue Balcom. Root Cellar Sue joins us from her farm outside of Mandan once a week for Main Street Eats. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And you want to talk about cover crops. this week.
Right.
So start us off with what are cover crops?
Okay, so I used to work for an organization called the North Dakota Grazing Lands Coalition, and I learned the term cover crop from that organization. And it's not, you know, it's a term that you would probably use, like if you were, biblically speaking, you're supposed to farm land for 6 years and then you allow it to sit for
That's
a year.
That's in the Bible?
Yes. It says in the Bible that you should plant 6 years and then give your gardens a rest, called summer fallow when I was growing up. But you can't leave your soil bare. So they always would plant something on it that was planted specifically to plow into the ground before it headed out and seeded. And so now with all this interest in gardening, and some of us have huge gardens, and so cover cropping is a good way to protect your soil when nothing is growing in it, but it also works as a living mulch because there are some cover crops that you can interplant with some of your other largely spaced crops, you know, like squash and things like that. But it works as a manure too, like a green manure.
What is a living mulch?
You know, that means that rather than cutting hay or cutting your lawn and letting it dry and putting that on top of your garden, you can put plant your crops and then plant these mulch crops in between and let that – it stays green. So it's like living in, you know, next-door neighbors to your plants that you have. Things that are – considered cover crops are legumes such as vetch and clover. There's beans and peas. There's these radishes that grow, you know, 4 feet down into the soil, kind of like bust the soil up. Ryegrass, oats, buckwheat. Buckwheat comes up so fast that I'm going to use that for a cover crop starting now in July, because as you pull out, you know, you pull out a cabbage, and you've got this great big huge bare spot in your garden. So you seed in buckwheat, takes, you know, 2 or 3 weeks to come up at the most, because that stuff grows like crazy. And before it seeds out, you mow it down and just leave it lay on top of your soil. And then when we harrow in the fall, that will get dug up and become nutrients for the soil and organic matter to make it like all fluffy, you know.
Well, that works for yours, your direct planting into the soil. What about for a raised bed? Can you put like a, what was that, buckwheat or rye? And then kind of, I mean, you're not going to mow a raised bed.
Right, but you still could cut that down.
Okay,
like hand trim it down.
Okay.
Or do you ever, like I take a broad fork after my raised beds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you do is cover it up. Like that'll kill it off, you know, before it seeds out.
Okay.
Put a landscape fabric or something over it and kill it
off. And you do that
off
before the winter, or you do that
yes
before the spring, following spring?
Your timing is critical. You do not want it to go to seed. So whichever
okay
cover crop that you select, of course, you have to keep an eye on it. Because like I said, God, I can't believe how fast buckwheat grows.
Hmm.
So if you're starting a new garden, this is one way to plan ahead, you know, dig your ground, get rid of your grass, whatever, and then sow a mixture. They make mixtures of different kinds
yeah
of crops that you can get.
Okay.
So some of it will be a nitrogen fixer, like your legumes fix nitrogen in your soil, but your radishes and all of these rooted things that they have in these mixes will bust that soil up, and then that will add all that beautiful organic material to your garden in the first year you plant it. It's really a good practice.
So is there kind of a golden ratio for that mixture, or would it change depending on what you're growing?
Rather than mix your own, I would definitely suggest that if you're going to use a diversified mix bag of cover crop, then you would want to there's large gardening supply stores that will actually sell you mixes. One of the drawbacks they say about using a mixed cover crop is that the nitrogen is being fixed by one plant and then absorbed by the other plant.
Mm-hmm.
But you plant these real thick. You know, you want them to be pretty thick. It's kind of like putting a microgreen covering in your garden. You know how thick you grow your microgreens?
I do. Yeah, it's the one thing I can grow really well.
And you know what? Me too. And it's so much fun because you can brush your hand across the top of those things. Mm-hmm. It's so super cool. That's a whole other story.
They are deeply satisfying.
Yes,
they are. Multiple levels.
Absolutely. And there doesn't – nothing gets easier than that.
Okay. So a mix is really not a bad idea.
Right. It's a good idea, and it's a good idea to kind of like think about probably what, you know, how long until you use your garden or what are you going to be planting in there and all that kind of stuff. Maybe the type of soil that you have would be kind of like, well, I don't know if it needs this or needs that. You know, there's all these questions or things that you can take a look at. But, you know, the theory behind this is basically you've got bare soil. And if you don't cover it up, Mother Nature will.
Right.
So yes. If you don't want the weeds to grow, it's good
to
get a fast growing.
The turkeys that come
growing.
In and take dust baths will plant. That's who plants my garden most of the time.
Yep. That's fun to watch, but they're destructive once in a while, you know.
They are, yeah. Well, let me ask you this. If you're good at crop rotation and you are good at cover crops, do you still need to let land stay unplanted for something that, you know, you want to be harvesting few years?
It's never a bad idea to give your garden a rest, like if you can afford to do that. But I don't know how many people can really, you know, like I don't have great big huge acres, and so I'd be hard pressed to say, well, let's see, I'm not planting that this year, but I am going to be a little bit more rigorous about keeping them covered when they're not planted. You know, I have raised beds that I grow garlic and shallots and whatever else leftovers in. And so once you harvest that garlic at the end of July, you know, that's bare. So rather than allow that just to be bare, I think just getting it covered, and that's kind of a rest in itself, is to have something in there that's actually adding nutrients to the soil instead of taking them out.
Do you need to do any kind of a soil test to determine what sort of cover crops you'd want?
You could, but if you're like me, it's all kind of a guessing game. Like, oh, that worked last year.
That's
Let's try something
works.
Different this year. Like, hey, I told someone today, I said, you know, if I actually could figure this out, like why one year, okay, you're like, I'm going to grow a bunch of picklers and I'm going to grow a bunch of dill and I'm going to buy some pickling spice and I'm going to put a pepper and some spices and make a little pickling kit for somebody. That's the year you won't get a single cucumber. Mm-hmm. Mother Nature's up there listening to you thinking, you're not in charge. And so, yeah, so I just kind of like what we always tell people, beginner gardeners that we talk to, whatever works for you is really the right way to do it, because every year I'm learning something new that I can use to make my gardening better. But in the end, it really is my buddy upstairs that gives me the ability to grow. You know, like I can plant and I can weed and I can sow, but only God can make it grow.
We check in with Sue Balcom once a week to talk about food. Thank you, Sue.
Thanks, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Capri Cafaro, host of Prairie Public's newest show, Eat Your Heartland Out, which airs Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Central this summer. One thing I learned in my previous life as a state legislator in Ohio is that no matter what the political divide, food is the best way to bring people together.
Basically, it is sharing of traditional food. When they eat it and they are asking how you make it and we making friends.
And that's what this show is all about. Food is our common denominator and a great way to tell our region's story.
When those three distinct cultures come together at one period, to me, that is the best opportunity to define what is Ozark cuisine or Ozark food.
We are going to spotlight the rich, yet often overlooked, culinary depth of the American Midwest.
There are massive communities of refugees here. Nepalese, Bhutanese, Somali, Iraqi, Iranian.
I'll be your audio tour guide to tell stories of cultural diversity, immigration history, migration patterns, and agricultural variations in each episode. It is Flyover Food No More. So I hope you'll join me every Tuesday for Eat Your Heartland Out at 8 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Decoded Datebook for July 22nd. By the early 1900s, amateur mechanics in North Dakota were building their own motor cars and whizzing down dirt roads at the mind-boggling speed of 8 miles per hour. The other rage of the time was aviation. North Dakotans were in on that, too. In 1910, Archie Hoxie created a sensation with the first successful North Dakota flight at Grand Forks. And there was Frances Klingensmith, the first woman in the state to get a pilot's license. She gained national fame as a stunt pilot and a racer. Even more famous, Carl Ben Eielson is known for flying over the Arctic ice caps. On this date in 1909, R. N. Metcalf, a farmer from Driscoll, revealed his plans for a fabulous flying machine. It was a combination of a land vehicle and an airplane and could even serve as a boat. Equipped with 8 propellers, the plane was designed to carry 10 passengers, or the equivalent weight in freight. Metcalf said that within 10 days, his prototype, designed to carry 2 people, would be ready to fly. Metcalf had been fascinated with flight since he was a boy. In 1908, he seriously began to explore plans to get an airplane into the skies. In 1909, he announced his plans. That October, he showed the plans to the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican. The newspaper thought it looked like a complicated mass of sails, propellers, and connecting rods. Metcalf asserted that it was not as complicated as it looked. The boat portion was lightweight canvas with a gasoline engine. That part of the machine would carry the passengers. 4 wheels allowed it to be driven on the ground like an automobile. When on the ground, the sails folded like the wings of a bird. Metcalf said that while the machine might need some tinkering, he was confident he was on the right track. Unfortunately, Metcalf's plans never got off the ground, and there is no further mention of his fabulous flying machine in the public record. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's lifelong learning community. Information about classes and events at humanitiesnd.org.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we have a couple of our Friday regulars. News director Dave Thompson stops by to add a little context and analysis into the week's biggest news stories. And we have a film review from movie critic Matt Olean as he watches Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.